Welcome to another episode of PMCA Research Chat. We start our new series on cannabis and confections and snacks with a discussion on perceptions of cannabis and edibles in North America. With me today is Brian Sterling of SCS Consulting. Brian is a founding partner and president of SCS Consulting, an international management consulting company specializing in strategic issues concerning the food industry, including cannabis-infused products. Until 2021, he was acting vice president of GS1's Cannabis Value Chain Optimization Program, aimed at creating a globally scalable traceability infrastructure for cannabis products in Canada. He was previously first president and chief executive officer for Safe Food Canada, an organization dedicated to strengthening the quality and consistency of food safety education. For almost 3 years prior to that, he was managing director of the Global Food Traceability Center located in Washington, D.C. From 2006 to 2012, he was first chief executive officer of Ontario's food traceability company, OnTrace. He has held senior management roles in several larger consulting firms, including IBM Canada and Fujitsu Consulting. He began his career with the DuPont Company. On today's episode, we will be talking about how new cannabis products with frequently exaggerated claims about the health benefits appear almost daily in the media. At the same time, consumers remain largely uneducated about cannabis. This has created markets in which folklore, misinformation, and guesswork fill the void. It would be useful to have clear data about what consumers perceive regarding cannabis and edibles. Edible cannabis products are already legal in many U.S. states and across Canada. However, they are still banned in many regions, and their future legitimacy remains unclear. This leaves both consumers and edible makers in a tough spot. On one hand, data tells us that edible forms of cannabis are becoming more popular as customers want to move away from smoking and have more discreet forms of indulgence. On the other, cannabis prohibition during most of the past century in North America has created serious gaps in our knowledge of the effects of cannabis and how to incorporate cannabinoids into commercial edibles. All these issues pose challenges for confectionery companies that seek new ways to grow and appeal to new consumer tastes. Today, we will look at recent market trends and consumer attitudes and perceptions around cannabis to set the stage for discussion of how to succeed with edibles infused with cannabinoids. Thank you, Brian, for joining us today. Have I missed anything? Is there anything you'd like to add before we dive in?
Oh, that was a lovely introduction, Eric. I was going to say, I said, if my parents were here, you know, my father would have appreciated it and my mother would have believed it.
Would you care to elaborate on what you do at SCS Consulting, as you seem to do more than just cannabis?
Yeah, the SCS Consulting was started originally as a business strategy firm, a boutique strategy firm. So there was a small number of senior consultants that I had met over the years, and we formed up this group to help mainly mid-sized companies and smaller companies deal with issues around their business strategy, marketing strategy. At the same time, in my background, I have been involved in food traceability since about 2004. And so that was one of the very specific areas we focused upon in the food industry. And it kind of moved from that discussion around 2015, the Canadian government started making noises about legalizing cannabis. And we immediately started getting phone calls because of our reputation around food traceability is we're going to be required to trace cannabis production and all of the packaging and so forth and so forth. So we wanted to ask you guys if you could help us out on traceability of cannabis. And so that's how we kind of morphed into the cannabis industry. But yeah, I would say if you were to give it a headline, it's a boutique management strategy consulting firm.
What percentage would you say of your clientele is in the edibles or cannabis realm?
Oh, that's a great question. I would say probably about a third of our clients, roughly speaking. Again, you know, it's in all aspects of the edible product's nature. So sometimes we're talking with beverage manufacturers, sometimes we're talking with confectioners, sometimes we're talking, believe it or not, with protein companies.
So, I was going to say, I would assume it's got to do with any kind of effective inclusion that's got to be traced by, say, the Canadian version of the FDA.
Exactly. You know, and it's not just for regulatory purposes. And that's what's really kind of, I guess what you would say our emphasis since we started doing this back in the early parts of the 2000s is that, Yeah, you've got to deal with the regulatory issues around traceability, but really where the money's made is in actually streamlining your own business processes. It's helpful to know where stuff is.
Right. Can you give us a rundown of who your customers might be with possible breakdown? Are we talking recreational, medical, wellness? What kind of spheres are we looking at there with regard to our customers?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, every region and every country is a little bit different, right? If I talk to somebody, say, in Oregon or Washington State, and I talk to somebody in Quebec, I may get very, very different answers. But, when we did our surveys, what we found was by far the largest group is what I would call the recreational consumer. And, you know, we can kind of break that down as being anywhere between 75 and sort of 80% of the total sales of cannabis. And this applies both in Canada and the United States. The specific numbers are a little bit different, but they're not off by much. So let's notionally say 3/4 of consumers are really consuming cannabis primarily for recreational purposes. About, I'd say, 8 to 10% of the markets in Canada and the US are in what we call medical. In other words, they have a prescription. There's a very specific symptomology that they're looking to address. And so that market, while it doesn't grow very quickly, is fairly steady. In other words, once somebody kind of finds their groove with cannabis on the medical side, whether it's for, you know, headaches and migraines, or whether it's for epilepsy or whatever it is, once they find that kind of fit, they tend to stay with it. So the market may not expand much, but it's very consistent. And then the other one is wellness. And wellness is less well defined. If I talk to consumers in the United States and in Canada, I'm going to get slightly different responses to, why do you use cannabis? Is it for wellness? But typically what we get there is somewhere around maybe 10 or 11% of the market is kind of looking at this as a lifestyle choice. So they're using cannabis in a number of different ways within their life. They might be cooking with it. They might be only using CBD type products rather than the more recreational THC products. It's not really well defined at this point, but we're estimating it's around 10 or 11%. Percent of the market.
Do you know if there's any research into that particular segment? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I see people like my parents are doing CBD because my sister suggested or whatever, or their doctor may hint that it may have a benefit in some physical or mental area. Is there any kind of transition from there to cannabinoids?
There's a number of different routes that it takes. And you're right. You're sort of talking anecdotally about, you know, how does one get into the medical area, right? Or how does, you know, typically people enter into the cannabis market through recreational use. And so the market tends to focus on that. If I was a confectioner, I'm probably looking at medical and recreational uses. Wellness is going to kind of do its own thing, and I may be able to find a very specific blend of cannabinoids that would work well in the wellness market. If that's only 11%, say maximum of the market, then, you know, do I really want to pursue that? Would it be better for me to kind of hone my products in the recreational side and then start to create the marketing program that would shift people's perspective over to more of a wellness kind of thing?
Yeah, it's follow the money. It's just a smart marketing plan.
Exactly. And so what we tend to find is that the recreational market just takes off like a rocket as soon as legalization occurs. And what will happen is while the black market may still sort of hang around, it starts to become less and less a factor in the market and legal products take over. Now, in Canada and the United States, we actually asked the question, since legalization has occurred, do you buy legal now and you've only ever bought legal, or did you buy it from the black market before and now you're buying it legal or whatever, right? And so we found some really interesting behaviors. And for the most part in Canada, I guess we must be really law-abiding, because something like 3/4 of the people who consume cannabis regularly tend to buy it for recreational purposes now, tend to buy it from the legal market. The black market or the legacy market or whatever they want to call it tends to be a smaller portion of the market in Canada than it is in the United States. But it's not 100% that way. Some states are you know, people are really, really loyal to their guy on the corner. And in other places, no, they've almost completely switched to legal. So it's a really dynamic marketplace. It's moving quickly and things shift around, which is why as a confectioner, it's a real challenge to kind of figure out, well, where am I going to, you know, make my first entree, or what kind of product is actually going to appeal that I'm going to actually get enough revenue to make it worthwhile for me to invest in this, right?
I'm going to use that as a springboard to my next question. Is there any product type preferred or differentiated between those three segments? For instance, the recreational people prefer a chocolate or gummy to something else, because that's all going to affect how your confectioner responds to production and their raw material.
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, when I saw the question pop up, I just sort of, you know, we could probably dig into the details of the data that we collected in these two surveys. One was done in Canada and one in the United States. Exactly the same questions. And we dug into the details of the data. It started to get to the point where the numbers were so small that it was difficult to make a statistical statement based upon what we saw in the data. But what we can say with a lot of confidence is if people do purchase an edible for whatever reason, whether it's for wellness or medical or recreational, if they do purchase an edible, we have a very clear picture of the differences between Canada and the United States and a lot of similarities. So for example, gummies are without question the most popular form of confection that contains cannabinoids. And there's good reason for that. I would say that confectioners would say relative to other confections, gummies are a fairly straightforward product to make. Now there's a lot of chemistry involved in that, but in the United States, gummies make up about 40% of the edible market. In Canada, it's about 35%. So they're not too far apart. However, what's interesting is you look at things like chocolate, you know, they're almost identical again. It's 12% in Canada and 10% in the United States of the total market. Where there's interesting differences is things like baked goods, for example. Canada, baked goods aren't a big deal with cannabis-infused products. Now, it might be that there's not a lot of manufacturers in Canada of baked goods that are also have cannabinoids in them. But in the United States, it's twice that level. It's 19%. So it's a kind of an interesting, you know, you kind of look at that and you'd say, well, why is that? Of course, we can't speculate on that. But what it perhaps means is that baked goods are A, in the United States, maybe more popular generally, whether or not they contain cannabis. Or it may be that the market is more willing to try something new in the United States. And Canadian consumers tend to be fairly cautious about that sort of stuff. That's speculative, but that might be what the reasons are.
It's really interesting to me because I never thought about it in terms of this, but I would make a general assumption that medical or wellness, you're probably going to lead more towards a chocolate or even a dark chocolate. But recreationally, gummies are just more fun, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that would be the kinds of questions that we could delve. As I say, when we delved into the data, we say, okay, so first of all, who consumes cannabis? Okay, so you get those people in a box. And then you say, okay, now who consumes edibles fairly frequently? And that it becomes a smaller box. Mm-hmm. And then you say, now, why do you do that? Right. And so what you end up with is this scattering of data that makes it a little bit challenging to kind of say, oh, with real conviction, oh, I know why chocolate is so popular, or I know why baked goods are so popular. But I think you're onto something, Eric. I think dark chocolate tends to be favored by people who are really conscious of positive benefits from chocolate. Whereas a recreational user probably doesn't care. All they want to know is how much THC is in this little
and what's it going to do to me? Is this going to make me sleep? Is it going to keep me awake?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So comparing the two markets, there's seems to be a lot of hesitancy on the federal level in the U.S. of just making a blanket statement to legalize, you know, cannabis.
Right.
Have there been any issues with regard to doing that? There don't seem to be any issues in Canada with regard to use, traceability, any of that kind of thing that would indicate why the U.S. is so hesitant, other than, you know, I don't want to get into the obvious reasons, this versus that. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It was interesting because when the Canadian government started to walk down this path, Canadian Constitution, the U.S. Constitution are totally different, right? Like in the U.S., however, we have provinces instead of states. And like in the U.S., the provinces are responsible for certain things. But when it comes to something like cannabis, the federal government was very clear on this. This is a national wellness issue. This is a national ban that currently exists on cannabis sales. So we have to address this as a nation. And that was the logic going into it. Now, when you break it down into the actual practical aspects of how do you implement and regulate it, it falls to the provinces, right? So the federal government sets up the framework and says, we're going to make it legal. Everybody that is over 18 years old can buy it, blah, 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 right? Unless the province decides to make some shifts, right? And within the framework, there's room for the provinces to maneuver around. In other words, some provinces decided, no, we're going to make 21 the legal age. Other provinces said 19. So that's the kind of little tuning that goes on.
They can tweak parameters per their region.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, well, how are you going to sell and distribute it? Each province does it a little bit differently. Some provinces do it totally government owned from end to end, right? And others, it's all private. And then most of them, like probably seven or eight of them, are all sort of mixtures of that. So you've got private business growing marijuana, and you've got processors who are private businesses and packagers who are private business, but then you get a distributor who is government, right? And so they have the warehouse with all the goods in it, and then they sell it out to the retail level, which is another private business, right? So you get different models in every province in Canada. And I think it's that flexibility that allowed Canada to move a little bit faster. Now, the downside to that model is that because you have slight differences from one province to the next, things don't quite fit together when you want to ask a simple question like, well, how much cannabis did you sell last month? So what you've got is everybody's got a different system, right? So there are some rules around finance and banking and things like that that are national. And then there are other things that are very regional. And it sort of makes for an interesting dynamic market.
How do they manage legally purchasing? All right, let me give you an example. We recently interviewed someone and we got into the details of the Delta 8 kind of situation.
Right.
Where he was saying, look, we're going to check IDs when people come in and buy a product from us, but they can go down to the street to the gas station and buy the same product and they aren't being carded. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how that possibly work, because now we're getting into the realm where anybody can buy it. A kid can buy a gummy. And you know what I mean? It's very, very strange.
The legal framework on cannabis is quite close to that for alcohol. So whether the retail outlet is a private company or it's being run by government, for instance, like in New Brunswick, it doesn't matter. The federal law is you cannot sell to anybody underage. And each province determines what that age is.
Okay.
But once you've determined that, you have to have in place the structure and the processes and enforcement that allow you to say with confidence, yes, we don't sell to minors, right?
Yes.
So somebody in a gas station theoretically could sell some gummies, but I'll tell you, it wouldn't last very long.
I don't understand how it works here, but in Canada, it seems like you're much more on the ball with regard to regulating who gets it.
Yes.
Final user.
Yeah. And I think it comes partly from the cultural differences between Canada and the United States. You know, and I've said this a number of times in some of our reports, when you see really weird looking numbers, like completely, I'll give you an example. We asked the question in Canada, the United States, you know, how do you feel about municipalities being able to ban retail sale of cannabis, right? In other words, do you want dispensaries controlled at the municipal level? In both countries, the predominant answer came back, no, we don't want municipalities just to be able to, on a whim, decide that they're not going to allow retail outlets in their territory. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It just means that most Canadians, and I think the number we found in Canada was 56%, the majority of Canadians believe that the municipality should not have that right. In the United States, the number was about 40%, right? So it's interesting to see those kind of numbers and you go, well, that's weird. Why is that? Right. So it seems to be that there's a cultural difference there, that Canadians are a little more comfortable with the fact that this is highly restricted. Right. And in the United States, maybe it's less so.
I would go even deeper than that and say that maybe in Canada, there's more of a trust of a government at a federal level managing things, whereas in the U.S., we seem a little less trusting of the guys at the top, if you know what I'm saying.
Perhaps. I wouldn't want to speculate on that.
No.
I've got my opinion of the federal government in Ottawa, too.
Yeah, I get it. Totally get it. So, Brian, in your opinion or experience, what makes chocolate a good carry for cannabis? Is it better than others, or is that dependent on the nature of the raw material?
Oh, I bet you Joel's got a really strong opinion on this. You ask a chocolatier, he'll tell you, well, because chocolate's better than anything else, right?
Well, it's got some interesting selling points. I'll give him that.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about the cannabinoids, first of all, a lot of people don't know about the fact that almost all mammals on Earth have what's called an endocannabinoid system, which means endo means within yourself. So quite literally, your body manufactures cannabinoids. And those cannabinoids are used for what's called homeostasis. In other words, it helps the body manage the sensations that it's feeling, pain, sleep cycles, things of that nature fall into the category of homeostasis. And those cannabinoids that your body are manufacturing every second of every day help maintain that stability in your body, right? And so what cannabis is doing is it's accentuating those, right? And so that's why CBD and other cannabinoids are being looked at really carefully for their medical properties, because the feeling is that, you know, there may be a balance here that we can strike that will actually start to mitigate issues like, you know, cancer or migraines or, you know, eating disorders or sleep problems or what. So all of those things come into play. And one of the things about the cannabinoids in cannabis that is interesting is what they're called hydrophobic. And that's a fancy word that basically means that they don't get along well with water.
Right.
And so when you talk about chocolate, it doesn't have a lot of water and it's got a lot of fat. And so it's the fat that the molecules of the cannabinoids combine to, and it just makes for a much more pleasant mouth experience as well as flavor experience, right? And so even though chocolate is far behind gummies in terms of their sale, there's a strong loyalty to chocolate because of some of the other benefits that chocolate provides. Plus, it tastes good.
To my previous point, it seems like people who want to legitimize what they're doing with their indulgence may lean more towards chocolate than gummies, you know, fun versus serious or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Do you know if there's any credible research being done on the effect of cannabis actives with regard to any particular malady? The reason I ask that is, you know, for years in the underground, you've always heard, you know, yeah, it cures cancer, does this, does that. But I don't know if I've seen any real credible peer-reviewed information where they've done studies to verify any of that.
There's a tremendous amount of research that's now occurring, right? I'll just make that statement. And it's not just in North America, but around the world because of the interest in what you're just talking about. There is credible and reviewed information around things like epilepsy, for example, around eating disorders. If you take chemotherapy, you lose your appetite. THC can actually help bring it back, right? Those are peer review studies that have come out in the last 5 years that kind of enforce that there's something going on here and we can actually scientifically show that. But when it comes to, well, it'll cure cancer, that's a very complicated question, right?
But you know what I'm saying? There's rumors out there about, you know, everything from hemp to you name it.
Yeah. I would say that what we're seeing is, you know, it's kind of like what happens when you take the top off a brand new bottle of pop, right? It tends to explode a little bit and sometimes rather catastrophically, and sometimes it just gives a little pop. But the point is that when you keep the lid on something for long enough, it'll eventually kind of come off. And I think what we're seeing now is after almost a century of almost 100% prohibition of anything that had to do with cannabis, we're now sort of seeing those lids come off and people are now moving forward fairly assertively in doing all of these kind of research projects.
particularly now that they can probably secure some kind of funding due to the legal status changing.
Funding is one thing, and it's actually just being allowed to do, right? Well, before, yeah, it was illegal to actually research cannabis, right? And it was just like, well, that's bizarre. We've been using it for, you know, almost 4,000 years. Why all of a sudden did we decide 100 years ago that we didn't want to have it anymore? So, and that's a whole other story, but I'm with you on that, is that what you're seeing now is people are, you know, the capital markets are now starting to become interested in it. The academic institutions certainly are starting to get interested in it, you know, and I work with a couple of them here in Canada, but I think it's just that everybody now is curious. You know, we've had this kind of lag of a century of kind of no knowledge being built up, and now we're being allowed to do that. So we're going to get into that market. We're going to do it. Yeah, there's money there, but it's also just a sense of curiosity.
Yep. You touched on the financial aspects of this. Mm-hmm. Can you reflect on, I mean, I know there was a lot of buzz when everything was becoming legal, as on this side of the border anyways, about corporate growers pushing out the smaller, that kind of thing. Any truth to that rumor at all? How do they source? I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but it's, you know, there was always a fear that you would have these big agronomy corporations coming in and taking over where they smelled money and pushing the little guys out, while losing that kind of tribal knowledge that the little guys may have had.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear that in Canada as well. I don't know what proof is there, but you're almost talking the same kind of language as what happens in the food industry, right?
Right.
You've got a certain number of growers, a certain number of packers, a certain number of distributors, and a certain number of retailers. And the biggest ones concentrate the market. And so in the United States, it's a little better than in Canada. In Canada, it's ridiculous. It's almost monopolistic, right? But in the United States, there's not a lot of large companies. And there might be 20 food companies that kind of get involved that really kind of dominate the market in the United States. And the same thing happened in cannabis in Canada. There were a number of companies like Tilray and Canopy and Aurora. There's a number of them that were very well capitalized. They had major league executive management, and a lot of them were hedge fund managers or bankers or what have you. And so they were driving the market forward, and it created that credibility. But to your point, the craft guys who really established the market, right? Let's be honest. It's the guys that were kind of doing this in the back rooms that really established the market and understand what the consumer is looking for. Those guys get overlooked now. And so they have to really fight hard to be heard in the marketplace. And so that complaint is almost universal. And I don't know, quite frankly, what the answer is, because in the food industry, it hasn't, you know, we've been talking about it for decades and it hasn't changed.
I'm wondering, as the legal situation in the U.S. resolves itself, if it'll parallel what you'd see in a grocery store, like you're going to have organic versus, you know, the regular versus the local, you know what I mean?
Yeah. There's
going to be segmentation, and everyone's going to have their niche, and everyone who prefers that particular niche is going to do that kind of, I don't know.
I'll give you an example. I had a client a few months ago, you know, we were talking strategy. And so we want to get, I have forgotten the exact words, but words along the lines of, we want to create a high quality premium product that will capture that value for our consumers and deliver an extraordinary experience. Some words like that. I went, well, that's really nice. What do you mean by premium? And they just sort of looked at me, and I said, well, you know, like, define for me what you mean by premium. I have no idea what a premium cannabis product would be. It's like saying premium beer. Beer is beer, right? So if you're talking about a craft product, well, then say that. Right. So point is that I agree with you, Eric, is that it's similar to wine and food, you know, like certain wines have a cachet and they build that up in their marketing effort. When you come right down to it, grapes are grapes, right? They're grown differently. They have different terroir and they're processed differently. And they have, you know, wine masters that are different and have different skill sets. But the reality is that the fundamental chemistry is all the same, right? So it's the same with cannabis. You've got this huge market and you've got a major part of it that's being served by what I would call, you know, the Bud Light, right? So you've got all this dried stuff that's going into that market. And then you've got the guys that really know what they're doing and they craft things that have got really interesting flavor profiles. They've got different kind of balances of cannabinoids. But how much is the consumer really going to pay for that? And how big is that market? You know, and that's the thing that people are groping for right now is they're trying, because it keeps changing on them. You know, they say, okay, we know how to serve this market. We're going to make cherry gummies because everybody wants cherry gummies. And the next thing you know, no, they don't want cherry. They want Coca-Cola flavor or something, right? You know, so those are the kinds of things that any new market is going to wrestle with. And I think that's why the confectioners are challenged to say, well, where do I step first? And where I would go is just what we've tended to advise our clients is to say, think about the things that you do really, really well. Is that an offering that the cannabis consumer is going to appreciate? Or will they just think you're being, you know, what's the word? Convenient, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the challenge that, as I see it, that the confectioners are faced with right now. They've got some really terrific products. And do I want to create a corporate brand for cannabis that's going to fit into that? Or maybe what I want to do is to create this standalone organization over here that's kind of behind the wall and let that organization kind of play around with it and discover what they have to do and then bring that back to the corporation, right? You know, so those are the kind of debates that we participate in now.
Everybody in R&D is going to cringe when I say this, but it's almost like marketing keeps pushing on everybody. Tell a story, tell your story.
Yeah.
Do what you do well, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I say, I think the job that we have as consultants is to just basically to challenge the conventional thinking of those organizations. You know, you can't let's take a crazy example, Smithfield's, right? Massive protein producer, right? Mm-hmm. Pigs and chickens and all that sort of stuff. So take an organization like that and say, okay, we're going to get you, you're going to make the world's best infused pork chops, right? Whatever. Crazy idea. Do you want to do that as Smithfield's or do you want to create, you know,
a brand?
Eric's brand, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
And then we don't have to worry about if somebody litigates, you know, we kind of protect the corporate brand. And so those are the kinds of interesting debates that are going on right now, but there's no question that people are getting into it. Right. Everybody that we've talked to, about a fifth of them, you know, about 20% of the time, they say, no, we're hanging in there. We're going to stay the course. The other 80% sort of fall by the wayside. Oh, this is too complicated. It's too expensive. No, we got more important things to do, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Yep. I really admire your enthusiasm. It's very infectious here, sir.
Thank you.
I'm going to segue into questions about major concerns.
Okay.
People have concerns around Halloween and this type of stuff getting into the hands of children. What can the industry do to counteract these rare but really well-reported overblown scares against the legal status quo that a large number of people want to believe is true?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I was recently doing some research work on psilocybin. It is a little bit more fraught than cannabis because now you're talking about products that really...
Oh, yeah.
They really are heavily psychoactive, right? A very little bit can send you a long way away from home. So one of the things that we were trying to understand is what are the hazards? What's the toxicity of this? And what I say to people is, you know, try and keep it fairly simple is toxicity is not in the actual chemical. It's in the dose. So I can take a dose of almost anything. If I take it small enough, it won't kill me, right? The thing with cannabis is it's very, very forgiving. It's really difficult. In fact, I haven't been able to find a documented case yet of somebody actually being killed by overdosing on cannabis. You can take a lot of cannabis and do something stupid like run your car into a tree. And you would say, well, that was the cannabis's fault. So he died from cannabis, but it's not poisoning, right? So my point is that there are certain products that it can be a lot more hazardous than cannabis. And so we have to kind of keep that as front and center is compared. And this is where the data in the United States is really excellent. If you go and look at the Poison Control Center data on cannabis and methamphetamine and heroin and all kinds of other opioids, as well as detergent pods, over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs that are actually supposed to be taken, and other things of that nature, alcohol probably being the obvious one. If you take all of that and you build up the numbers, you get a huge hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cases every year in the United States. And that number, those numbers are available. You look at where cannabis sits in there, and it's really hard to find, right? There are more kids die from getting access to alcohol or an over-the-counter drug than anyone will from cannabis. So I agree with you. It tends to get overblown because people have this social stigma in their mind about the devil's lettuce, right? Yes. So it's hard to combat that. And that's why when we talk to companies, we say it's not going to be entirely on you to solve this problem, but your industry definitely needs to address it. And not just the cannabis industry, but the industry that is attached to it. In this case, we're talking about confectionery. So the confectioners need to get their story straight about what's the responsibility of the manufacturer, what's the responsibility of the retailer, and what's the responsibility of the consumer? Because we allow people to drive cars and they kill more people every year than anybody's ever been killed with cannabis. But we don't ban cars, right? So it's the same argument that we get into when we talk about other things. And so if we're going to allow cannabis to be used legally, then there's a responsibility on those who consume it to keep it safe.
Correct.
I can't state it any more bluntly than that. We had the usual nonsense last Halloween up here in Canada as well. You know, three kids in Vancouver. I said, three kids? Are you kidding? They probably had 30 kids in hospital that month because they overdosed on aspirin, right? You know, so
yeah.
It's trite to say it, but it's only through education that people are going to learn this. And it's not a magic bullet. It doesn't happen overnight. You just have to keep
hammering
away and drilling. And it's, again, it's the whole disinformation industry that seems to be out there that just relishes generating this, quite frankly, this nonsense, right?
And what's really interesting is the revenue that could be generated if we just accept it and move on. Instead of any excuses leveraged to not legalize something is, to me, ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, it is a little bit of the nanny state, right? Mm-hmm. The most hilarious example of that, Eric, was very early on in the legalization of cannabis in Canada. And edibles had not yet been legalized. Edibles became legal a year after cannabis was legalized. And the only reason they did that is they wanted to give people time to kind of, you know, get their act together in terms of communications and stuff like that. But it was really funny because some police in Toronto had gone into a store and had seen some and spotted some illegal edibles, right? So, you know, they didn't arrest the guy because cannabis is legal, but they did cite the guy. They gave him a fine and they took away the product. And of course, one of them decided to try it. And I'm going, as you do, right? It's just like, what was this guy thinking? Oh, I can try one of these and just to see how it is. Anyway, apparently it was hilarious because they actually got on the radio and they were explaining to the staff sergeant at the other end that, you know, they were experiencing these odd feelings. So they sent a cop car around, right? Maybe these guys have been poisoned or, you know, whatever. Oh. And of course, the whole story tumbled out the next day on the news. And I mean, people were just like in tears. They were laughing, right? You know, just like, oh my God, you know. And of course, others would use that as, well, you know, here we are. This is exactly the sort of thing we're talking about.
it's a slippery slope into the devil's path.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in the education aspect about this. It's just, when we started down this path, Eric, with our clients, the first almost first year that we were in it. And it's almost always the first, very first meeting with any client is just to educate them on cannabis. They know nothing, right? You know, and so that's why I thought this podcast was a great idea, because it's an opportunity to kind of get some information into people's hands that's real, right? These are real surveys that have been done on people who actually participate in this market. And so we found that the education aspect of this, just explaining what cannabinoids are, just explaining how it works in your body, how long has it been around? Why is it illegal? And then, you know, and now it's legal. You know, all of those kinds of questions are what come tumbling out, because people are craving that information. And so what I believe is that is one of the big keys. Some of the other ones are in the hands of the industry. Some of the other ones are things like quality and consistency, you know, and I'm sure Joel talked about this. One of his strongest suits is the consistency of his product, you know, always the same. The same thing with gummies. The gummies that I have personally used, always the same, consistent, reliable. You know exactly what you're going to get and how you're going to feel.
And that's just the business as well.
Yeah. And transparency is the other thing. For instance, you know, we talked about traceability earlier, but, you know, just educating people on, you know, here's where it's grown. Here's how it's grown. Here's how we process it. Here's what's in this product. Here's the effect that you might feel or that others like you have felt. And so a lot of people say, you know, the way of marketing in the cannabis market is going to be through education. It's not going to be fancy graphics. And I mean, that'll help. But what's going to really kind of break the market open for some of these confection companies is educating the consumer on why would I want to buy this product and what's in it for me, right?
You know, it would behoove some of them to go downstream, because I've been in some situations where the guys selling these products are all about informing you what you're taking, where it came from, what's in it, what effect it has. You know what I mean? At the ground level, at the retail level, I don't have extensive knowledge of this, but several of the places I've been in seem to really want to educate their customer base on the whole thing. They're into it, you know, and that's great.
It's really interesting. We actually asked the question in the United States and in Canada when we did this survey. We actually asked the question, you know, who do you look to for reliable information? Really interesting responses. I would say the largest group in the United States are the bud tenders.
Yeah.
So people go to the retail level and that's where they're looking for their information. Now, in Canada, that's the second highest one. The highest one actually is government information.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm astonished, because the government information is, it's accurate, but it's essentially useless, right? So, you know, it's not that it's untrue. It's not that it's not giving you some information, but it always comes from the perspective of hazard reduction.
It's right? Massaged.
Yeah. It's always about, you know, being worried about you overindulging. Right. As opposed to a bud tender is going to say, look, you're an adult. You know what you're doing. Here's what we've got. Right.
Yeah. It's more of a libertarian approach. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you take a much more collaborative, much more educational approach rather than this kind of preachy, you know, as I call it, the nanny state. Right.
Yeah. Yep. Has price impacted any of this at all with regard to production, even as far as down to the retail level? Or do people seem less concerned about that than other particulars of what they're doing?
Yeah, super question. Price is always a factor. I wouldn't say it's the most important factor for a lot of people. It's more about the experience that they're looking for. That's why the market's so dynamic, because people are moving around, right? Oh, I'm going to try gummies, then I'm going to try chocolate. I might smoke some, or I might get a vape cartridge, or I might go out and buy an expensive vaporizer, whatever, right? You know, they're figuring it out. Right. And I think price is one of those factors that comes into play, particularly when you're talking into the medical market.
Right.
Because, of course, those people, quote unquote, need to take it, as opposed to, well, I'm going to get high.
Yeah, right? I'm going to do this once a week or once a month, and I don't care if I spend $20 on a bar.
Exactly. You know, so when people tell me, oh, weed's really expensive, I go, no, it's not. weed is cheap, right? But the reality is it's probably more expensive than going out and buying a beer, right? But not by much.
It's your return on investment, right?
Yeah. Price isn't really a huge determinant from what I can see. And the prices in Canada have actually pretty much collapsed because there was just so much weed chasing too little demand, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I laugh whenever I read stuff on LinkedIn or, you know, some client sends me a note or something like that saying, oh, you know, we're going to get into the export market. I'm, no, you're not. You know, you might think you're going to get in, you're not going to get into the export market for at least another 5 years. So, you know, that's not what's going to make you successful today, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to plan for that, go ahead and do it and start to line up your financing and start to look at your distribution and all that. But there's not many countries. In fact, there's probably only one handful that are actually importing cannabis from other countries, you know? And so Germany is probably the biggest one, but I mean, there's not many others. So Canada doesn't import weed, not legally.
So from your perspective, where do you see this whole thing going in the next 5 years?
I think what you're going to see is the continued acceptance of cannabis. It's already pretty high. The numbers in the United States and Canada are very similar. I think it's like 78% of Canadians and 75% of Americans are accepting of legalization. Now, that doesn't mean 75% of them are, you know, smoking up every day. But,
right,
you know, there's an acceptance there, right? So, okay, it's going to be legal, fine, right? There's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation, as we've talked about through this entire conversation, about, you know, what effects are there and how is it made and what is it going to do to me and how about my kids and how about my pets and all these other questions that are swirling around. I think what we would hopefully see is the industry start to take more responsibility about settling down and actually helping inform the public, as opposed to constantly looking at, well, how am I going to manage my inventory, or how am I going to get, you know, my next round of capital funding, or whatever, right? There's got to be more of a focus on the consumer. And I think that hopefully is a trend that we're going to start to see develop over the next 5 years.
I would say then,
naturally is going to lead to a lot of consolidation in the industry, because you're going to have businesses opening and closing, retailers opening and closing, being acquired. I think that's a trend you're going to see for the next 5 years. And I think hopefully we're going to actually start to see some real progress around, you know, just being able to market it effectively. That right. doesn't mean going out there and having ads on TV during the Super Bowl. That just means...
Although that would be interesting.
That would be interesting. Yeah, have Snoop Dogg get up there and tell us, you know, oh, that's some mighty fine, right? You know,
yep.
there's this whole aura around cannabis still that it's somehow, you know, kind of quasi-illegal, and I'm not so sure about it. And everything. Now, people have, I think, at least in Canada, people have kind of gotten over that. There's a hardcore, as there is on most issues, there's a hardcore maybe of 20% of Canadians who want nothing to do with it. And that number has not changed since 2017 when we started doing these surveys. That's pretty consistently there.
That's interesting.
So you're not going to change those people's minds, which is fine. But, you know, 80% of the population is kind of going, meh.
Yeah, they don't care. Yeah. Anything else you want to touch on before we wrap this up? This has been fantastic, Brian. I absolutely loved this hour.
Oh, that's great. I really appreciate it too, Eric. I really enjoyed it. I think one more comment I would make around, you know, what can the industry be doing would be around the question of standards. And I imagine that Joel may have gotten into this topic a little bit because it's one that's near and dear to his heart as well, I think. There isn't a consistent standard around when you look at a package of cannabis or an edible or something like that, and it says, okay, this cannabis flower is 22% THC and less than 1% CBD. Okay, how do you know that? Well, we tested it. Okay, what was the test and what was the lab? There is no consistency in behind that screen. And so I could take the same cannabis and send it to a different lab and perhaps, more than likely, in fact, get a different result. And so that's an area where I think the industry is really, they're focusing on it, but I think they really need to get a sense of urgency around it. It would be like going into the liquor store and saying, oh, this bottle of vodka is 40% alcohol, 40%-ish. You know? So it's kind of one of those things where it seems at this moment, that's not the most important thing to be thinking about, but in 5 years' time, it is going to be important, right?
Yeah, it should be, because that's going to moderate your dosage.
Absolutely.
And it's going to impact your bottom line if you aren't managing those percentages.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and everything else that counts on us. So as a confectioner, when you get, and this is where Joel would have talked, when you get that cannabis, either the isolate or, you know, an extract of some kind or what have you, and it has a certificate of authenticity saying this is how much THC is in it, et cetera, you rely on that to calculate how much you put into your chocolate or your gummy or your hard candy or what have you, right? And if it's wrong, you can end up shortchanging the consumer or giving too much to the consumer, right?
Yeah.
And so they get an unpleasant experience. And guess what? In both cases, they're not coming back, right?
Right.
So that's why the industry, I think, is going to eventually need to wrestle this to the ground and say, okay, there's going to be a standard that's going to be applied to how the lab tests your product. And this is the standard. And you have to be certified to that standard by one of these three certification bodies, right?
Like we do with anything else in chocolate, you know, whether
exactly.
It's, yeah. You know, yeast and molds or moisture or staff, yeah. Whatever, you know, they're going to lay out whatever the particular test was and tell you what the results were. So everything's the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
But that's about it.
Cool. You got anything else you want to plug? Website or anything?
Well, if anybody, I won't plug the website because it's boring. But if you want to talk to me, people know how to reach out to me. I'm yep. more than happy to talk to people.
Cool. Well, next time I'm up there, I'm going to have to track you down.
Well, that would be fun. You know, and I'll walk you around a couple of dispensaries and we can take a look at some of the differences and similarities, and it'd be kind of fun.
That'd be fun. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. And we look forward to more information on this topic. Thanks again.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Eric, for your time.